We'll make a start. Page 32, which is chapter 9. Before we begin, I want to make two dedications. Number one, this is in memory, Lilui Nishmot. Firstly, today, Abe Weintraub, who normally is here regularly, is on a plane flying to Israel. Unfortunately, his father passed away, Harav Yaakov David Ben Harav Aaron. And I want to dedicate the shir in his memory. I met him a number of times, and it's just an interesting thing that he was born and bred in Meir Shearim. Abe's grandfather was one of the Gaonim, one of the great Rabbonim of Meir Shearim, Rab Aaron Weintraub. Wrote a sefer that Abe very often quotes from, which is very interesting. And his father seems to have been the black sheep of the family. He went into the Haganah, he fought in the War of Independence, and they left Israel, I think, in the 50s or early 60s, I'm not sure exactly when. And the whole family there is very much in the Meir Shearim style. You know, the Abe's cousins and whatever who are out there, as far as I understand, are all members of the Purushim, they are the Ashkenazi community in Meir Shearim. It's quite amazing. And he was a very, very, very tzanua man, and also very great balkara, very, you know, medagde, very careful in his kriyas haTorah, very, very interesting to hear him. I heard him lay a number of times, which is where Abe gets it from. So I want to dedicate the sheer memory of Jacob Weintraub, Zichron Livrocha. Also want to mention another person that passed away in my family, my wife's family, an aunt, Chana Malachi, Zichron Livrocha, who passed away last week, at the age of 90. And she was one of the founders of Kibbutz Lavi. She went with her husband from England. They went on the Mapilim, which is the legal boat, in 1947. He was the oldest person on the Kinder transport. It's very interesting. He got to London in 1938. He was just a day before his 18th birthday, and he was allowed to leave Germany, which is quite remarkable. And they went to Lavi. They set up the kibbutz in the late, after the Hakamat Medina. I don't know where they went initially, but I think Lavi started in 49, 50. They lived in a tent for, you know, you can write books about these people. 3 years, I think, they lived in tents there. And they were remarkable people. They had a lot of tragedies in their lives. But at the same time, to see the kibbutz go from being literally the side of a hill, a rock, and it became such a Gan Eden, such a Garden of Eden there, it's just something very special. She was Nifta last week. They finished the Shiva on Thursday. And again, I want to dedicate this Shiva Le'ilui Nishmata, Chana Bat Binyamin, Zichron Olivracha. Okay, so this evening we're going on to Perek Tet. And again, it's very, very apropos that we're remembering two people who coming from very different backgrounds, but are united through Eretz Yisrael, and as I think, you know, we all are in one way or another. I just want to talk a little bit of a hakdama, a bit of an intro, before we get into chapter 9 and the problem of the expectation of the world. The world expects us to always do the right thing. We know that, all right? You know, I was just reading today, I was just mentioning before, that there is a big hullabaloo in England because one of the MPs who's in the government, I think on the one side of the government, has made some sort of statement. They had Holocaust Memorial Day, the 27th of January, because that was the day that Auschwitz was liberated. So in many European communities, they have adopted that as the day of memorial. So somebody got up and made a speech, maybe not in honor of this. He was at a Holocaust memorial gathering, and got up and said, "Well, how tragic it is that the people who suffered at the hands of the Nazis are behaving like Nazis towards the Palestinians." Unbelievable statement, unbelievable. And you know, it's created a hullabaloo in the government there because you know this is really even the government of England sort of realizes the UK that this is an unacceptable statement, but when you think about it, where's it coming from? And it's the same story over and over again. The expectation of Am Yisrael, with the people of the book, this week, Parshat Yitro, receiving the Torah, Sinai. All right, we became Sinah. That's where the hatred comes from. It comes from the word Sinai and Sinah. In Hebrew, to hate is Sinah. Why do they hate us? Because Sinai. Because what happened at Sinai? We became moral guardians of the world, right? We were given a code. We were given the books of Torah. And we were told to guard them and to teach the world how to behave, how to be a mensch. And the problem is that they hated it for it. They hate us for it because, you know, we come along and say, well, this is right, this is wrong. We become the kind of the measuring, you know, the way that the world can measure morality. And they don't like it, especially in the ancient world. They didn't like it at all because they liked to behave like behemoths. They weren't particularly interested in morality. And along come this group of people and announcing to the world that you've got to be a moral human being. All right, and of course, monotheism and everything else that went with it, belief in one God, all of that created and still creates the expectation when it comes to Israel, Israel's got to do the right thing in every circumstance. So, and when we do the right thing, we still get criticized. All right, which country in the world sends text messages to the enemy that we're coming to attack you, but we'll give you a warning, a heads up, get out of the buildings because the buildings are harboring terrorists. Okay, or they sent leaflets from airplanes flying over Gaza. And people ignore all of this. People ignore, so much of what is out there, and they like to be selective. And of course, we get blamed for doing things and not recognizing the fact that we try to raise it to our highest standard. I remember in the army when I was in basic training in Israel, we were on Konanot, the first Shabbat I was in. And it was a bit of a shock to the system being in the army on Shabbat, but it was really much more of a Shabbos than I expected it to be. It was really quite remarkable. And the chicken soup was a bit Sephardi, but it was still chicken soup. It was really interesting. And the fact was that we were planning. They wanted us to be ready in case that this was pre-intifada, the first intifada. So they wanted us to be ready in case there was a riot in Shechem. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I didn't know what to do in a riot. I had no clue. None of us did. But they said to us, look, you'll just be backup. Fine, thank you. And thank God nothing happened that Shabbos. But what did happen is spent the whole Shabbos talking about the morality of what we're doing regarding the Arabs. And what army in the world discusses that? You know, that you're sitting there discussing issues of morality against your enemy. In other words, should we behave? How are we behaving correctly? Are we doing this right? Are we doing that right? The whole Shabbos, it was unbelievable. I'll never forget it. And again, this is something very unique. And chapter 9 of Sefer Yehoshua, you'll see where it comes from. Right, learning Tanakh, as I always announce or promote, is the idea of finding out who we really are, finding out where we come from, finding out our roots, finding out where all these ideas, where all these moral ideas and ideals, where they really come from. And this is very, very interesting. What we'll do, we'll look at the story of chapter 9, the story of the Givonim, and one or two issues that we need to think about in terms of the story, in terms of the background of the story. As we go along, we'll explain what was happening here. Remember, we finished Ai. Ai is now no longer with us. The Ais are gone. And Jericho has been conquered, right? So the reputation is going out there. The reputation of Yehoshua and of the Jewish people. And the end of chapter 8 was particularly significant because remember they built a mizbech, they built some sort of altar, and on the side of this enormous construction, they inscribed the words of the Torah. Now, was it the whole Torah? Was it the Aseret HaDibrot? You know, we talked about that. There are different opinions what they have, but they clearly made a statement to the whole of the population living in Eretz Israel, Eretz Canaan, that we are here to stay. Yehoshua, good evening. Yehoshua inscribed this on the side of the Mizbeah. It was an inscription which was there, and it made a statement, not only in behalf of the Jewish people, but on behalf of Yehoshua. Yehoshua is a bit like sort of Declaration of Independence. Okay, you know, you talk about Washington, you talk about the Congress and everything else that comes together with it, and there's an individual, and there is a representative body that he or she would represent. In this case, Yehoshua representing the Jewish people. So I just want to say that because you'll see that becomes significant in chapter 9. Okay, so page 32. We're just going to go through a bit of the text of this perek, and then you'll see where we're going. Vayihi, kishma kol ha-malachim, right? Pasuk Aleph. All the kings heard, asher be'evar yarden, who are on the other side of the Jordan, in other words, in the land of Canaan, bahar, bashvela, b'chol chof ha-yam ha-gadol, They were all over the place, right? On the mountains, on the low area, what, near Tel Aviv, as we would say, and the Chof Hayam, and that's the whole coastal plain, which is Tel Aviv and Netanya and all the rest of it, whatever they were called in those days. El Mul Lebanon, right up to Lebanon. It's going right up to Sidon and beyond. Hachiti, Emori, Aknani, Aprisi, Achivi, Hayavusi. If you count that list of the tribes that were in Israel, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We also got 7. Seventh tribe is missing. The Girgashi. What happened to the Girgashites? All right, so the Seychazal, they got the message and they ran away. And they went off to Africa. Right, that's the tradition. So they became, wherever they went, maybe they went to Ethiopia, maybe they went further. We're not quite sure, but they got the message. And as they say in the cartoons, exit, stage left, they were out of there, they were gone. So there's only 6 groups that remain behind. Another bit of background, which is something we mentioned before. Yeshua sent out proclamation. He sent letters before they crossed the Yarden. He sent messengers to all of these groups, and he gave them 3 choices. He said, choice number 1, you can leave peaceably, all right? Because we're here to claim our ancestral land. Choice number 2 is that if you want to stay, we're going to make peace, okay? And choice number 3, if you don't want to do that, then you're going to have to face a war, right? Those were the 3 choices. And when you make peace, it was under certain conditions that they would accept what is called the 7 Noahide laws. They didn't have to become Jewish, but they would have to become monotheists, right? Which was a status known in Hebrew, Ger Toshav. That's what they eventually called Ger Toshav, the status of being someone who dwells in Israel with an awareness of the existence of God and keeping the laws of Noah. Okay, don't steal, no murder, etc., etc., all of the famous laws. So that was the deal. And the Girgashites got the message and they disappeared. They left. So they're not in the mix anymore. But these 6 nations who basically don't want to accept any sort of compromise with the invading Jewish army, all right, what do? Bet, vayitkabtsu yachdav lilachem im Yehoshua v'Yisrael. They're going to fight with Yehoshua and Yisrael. And again, why does he single out Yehoshua? And what we said before, and this is Rav Mali in this Sefer that I've been quoting, points this out, that that Yehoshua became the leader, the outstanding leader, that for them represented the leadership of the Jewish people that are coming into Eretz Yisrael, and particularly the fact that he put this constitution on the stone, on the altar. That really sort of set him up as being that a role model, that figure that would become the leadership. So they had their argument not only with Am Yisrael, but with the leader of the Jewish people, with Yehoshua. And that's why he's mentioned, because he more or less established the constitution by writing the Torah on the side of the Mizbeach in that story we had at the end of chapter 8 on Har Eival, Har Grizim and Har Eival. And it says Pe'echat, that they were united. Okay, which is always the same. The Arab comes together, the enemy unites them. Okay, amongst themselves, they could kill each other very nicely. And as you see, what they're doing in Syria, and now they're doing it in Egypt. But when it comes to the common enemy, all of a sudden, they forget their differences, which is one of the terrible ironies of the Middle East situation then, and unfortunately still today. Gimel, v'yoshvei Givon. Now there's one group that decided that, you know what, we are going to try and get out of this dilemma. What's the dilemma? Because they saw that they're not going to win. They saw that the Jews, on the one hand, they can fight with miracles, Jericho. They saw that God was on their side, the God of Israel. On the other hand, they saw from the Battle of Ai, they can also fight with swords and spears, right? They had to go and have a battle. 2 battles, in fact. So the people in Givon, which is to the north of Jerusalem, just past Ramot, right, if you go up the Ramot Road and you go sort of over the hill to, well, now 443, right through to the airport towards Modi'in, you've got the whole area which was known in those days as the area of Givon. Okay, and we're going to say a little bit about that later. So these people who dwelt there said, "We've got a real problem. Whichever way we look, we are done in. We are ended. We can't survive." So they decided to try and make a ploy. And of course, we'll see in a minute the big question why they had to do this, but you'll see in a minute. V'yoshvei Givon, Pasuk Gimel. So the dwellers in Givon, this is to the north of Jerusalem, Shamuet kol asher asah Yehoshua l'Yericho, v'la'ai, they heard of the whole history, what happened to Jericho, what happened to Ai, and they got worried. V'yasu gam hema ba'orma. So what did they do? They did a trick. They tried to use a ruse. What did they do? V'yelcho v'yitzdayar. They went and they disguised themselves. They basically, what they did is they made themselves look as if they are coming from a very long journey. Not from Givon, which is 5 minutes away. Literally, in the car from Jerusalem to Givon is 7 minutes if you go from the center of Jerusalem. It's that close by car. Not even by walking. It'll take you maybe an hour and a half to walk up there. But the reality is that it's a question of showing that they, or at least they want to try and convince the Jewish people they're not part of the Canaanite group. All right, they are a different bunch of people, and they are trying to save their skin. So what are they going to do? They're going to be yitzdayar. They're going to make themselves disguised. They're going to look as if they come from a long way. Vayichus sakim balim lechamorehem, and they put on their animals some worn out sackcloth, which you know looks as if it's traveled a long way. Vnodod yain balim, and their water bottle, their yain, the wine bottles are very worn out. Look as if they've been traveling. Right? And they've got holes in them and they're tied together. They basically looked as if they had traveled a long, long way. Now, what's the ruse? Listen to this. Hey, and they didn't spare any detail. It's an interesting story. And they had worn out shoes, right? They looked as if they'd been crossing the desert. Uslamot balot alem, and the clothing looked a bit shmattery, worn out. And they had this horrible dried bread, right? In the notes over here, he says this is like the hard tack. You know what hard tack is? You know what they used to give to sailors on the boats? Okay, that it would not go moldy after 3 days. Nowadays they use preservatives, so I suppose it's a bit easier to keep things going for a bit longer. But in those days, they had the, you know, like dried meat and hard tack, and this is basically what he's comparing it to. Fine. They had all of this to impress the group that they were meeting. Obviously, they were going to come to the Jewish camp, and they were going to say that, you know what, we want to become part of the Jewish people. We heard about what the God of Israel has done and everything that's happened, and we want to convert. And they think they can get away with it. Now, this is so interesting. And we're going to try and get into the mind of Yehoshua. What's going on in Yehoshua's mind? Is he naive or is he not naive? That's the question. Okay, you'll see in a minute. Va'yelchal Yehoshua el ha'machaneh ha'Gilgal. So they went to Yehoshua, to this camp where he was. Va'yomer elav el ish Yisrael. And they said to him and to the Jewish people. So they were appealing to the leader plus, you know, the representation, but maybe not everybody, but they had a group that they were appealing to. Me'eretz rechoka banu. They claim they came from a long way away. Absolute lies. They came from down the road. But they looked as if they came from a long way away. Ve'atah kirtu lanu brit. We want to make a covenant. In other words, we want to be your friend. We want to join. We want to be part of the Jewish people. Wow. Ve'yomer ish Yisrael.
If he gave them the opportunity of staying in the land.
Yeah.
And
that's the question. The Ramban asked the question. The Ramban asked this famous question. Why did they have to go through the ruse? The answer is, and one of the answers is like this, that when the letters were sent, it was from the other side of the Arnon. There was a time limit. They blew it. They didn't answer in time. They got the letter, according to some interpretation, that they got the letter, but they didn't reply. And now, once they saw how the whole thing was playing out, you're stuck. You can't just backtrack. You were given a time frame. You went past that certain deadline, and you were stuck. The other suggestion is that maybe they never got the letter in the first place. You know, the mail in those days might not have been as which is a very interesting suggestion.
Pony Express,
or the Camel Express was even worse. There is that. I mean, that's a famous answer to the question why Yosef did not write to his father for 22 years. He's in Egypt for 22 years, never sent a postcard to his dad in 22 years. So some suggest, you know, which I saw was a ridiculous suggestion, but anyway, that, you know, the mail wasn't so good, so it doesn't take 22 years to send a camel from Egypt up to Israel. It may take 5 days, 6 days, not 22 years. There are other reasons for that, but whatever. There are different suggestions. The Ramban's question is absolutely a valid question. So they are in a situation. There are other suggestions as well. Just hang on a second. Let me, because there's four suggestions the Ramban gives. I've just got it here on a page. I don't want to give it out, but I'll just read it to you. Lo yodu klal shetov aleim hodato shel Yoshua kriyato l'shalom. Rag yodu al mitzvah achreim tachrim. In other words, they didn't know that Yoshua would actually invite them to join. All they heard about was that the Jews were going to destroy them. So they heard there was destruction. That was problem number one. Or kiblu kvat hachrazato. They received Yoshua's letter, but they didn't make the peace overture in the right time, which is what we suggested. Or number three is that yodu alef sharud lashlim. They knew about it. Lo rotzu, they didn't want to make peace at the beginning. They thought they could ride the crest of the wave. And number four, be'emet ichdu lashlim. That he says, in essence, what they were doing is that they were coming together. Ichru lashlim. They were late. In other words, they were always thinking of making peace, but like in everything in the Arab world, you know, it's something where the difference between the dream and the reality. I'm sure there are, like today, there are many, many, probably thousands upon thousands of men in the street who just want to say, enough already, you know, we can get on here. If we made peace with Israel, you know, the whole lives would change. The whole standard of living, everything else, and the leadership is so corrupt. I mean, how can you live with such corrupt leaders for so many years? Be it Arafat or this guy Abu, whatever his name is, and all the rest of them. It's just a disgrace.
Since they were a subset of Chivis, I would think that if they went ahead and did something outside the rest of the Chivi nation,
yeah. And they could also be in a serious danger from
the Arab world now.
Yeah,
peace.
Yeah, they kill them. They kill them straight away. I know. And that's a very good suggestion, absolutely. So whichever way you look at it, there's no question that, you know, peace was it was a risky gamble, this. But the fact that they didn't take the peace initiative in the first place, you know, Abba Ibn, you're back to the same famous statement that they missed an opportunity. They missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Where does that come from? It comes from this whole story, right? We're going back 3,000 years and it's the same thing. They never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. It's terrible. It's a terrible thing. But they, in this case, they were smart. At least they thought they were going to be smart. The question is Yoshua taken in by this? Listen to this. Very interesting story. So, let's see where are we? Pasuk Zayin. Okay, so they want to make a covenant. So vayom ish Yisrael alachivi ulai bekirbi ata yoshev ve'ech echrot lecha berit. So the answer goes back to them to say that, you know, that how can we make a covenant if you're going to live amongst us? And this, of course, is really the heart of the problem, is that once you accept the nation of idolaters amongst you, they would have a negative influence upon you. And that's part of the original reason why the mitzvah was that if they don't accept peace on your terms and live according to your standard, you have to kill them. That was the original mitzvah of Lo Techayeh Kol Neshama. That's a whole discussion by itself, I don't want to go into now. And that was the reaction. But they replied. So they said to Yoshua, we will be your servants. We know that this means that we have to compromise. But you know what? Better to compromise than to be dead. So Yeshua said, in that case, who are you? Where do you come from? All right, now he's prepared to talk to them because they've said that they will accept the authority of the regime which Yeshua has to impose on them. So Vayomer, Pasuk Ted, it's an interesting story. Didn't even say where they came from. You know, far away. The Golden Medina, wherever the Golden Medina was, yeah.
Pasuk Zion, it says,
"Vayomru
ish Yisrael." I assume that's
Yoshua,
right?
No, it's the men of Israel. It's the whole community saying to them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, and of course, there's a kriketiv here because it's Vayomer, and we read it Vayomru, right? You'll see that what it says at the bottom, Vayomer kriek, correct? You read it Vayomer. Because it was like in unison, the community said, we can't have this, you can't live amongst us. And then Yoshua basically tries to, you know, negotiate. So it's interesting that it's really more about Yoshua than it is about the community. The community basically said, the first reaction was, no, we're not going to accept you. Yoshua is prepared to talk. And again, this throws up the whole question, was Yoshua naive? Was he ignoring the evidence, you know, which you'll see in a minute becomes very blatant? Or does he have another agenda? And that's something that we're going to get to, hopefully it's before the end of the year. So I want to show you this because it's very interesting. We'll just get through this text. So, we come from far away, for the sake of God. In other words, you know, we're religious pilgrims. We heard about what happened in Egypt, and they give a history lesson. We know what happened to the two Amorite kings, which still remains in history, even though this is already, you know, sort of a number of years afterwards, they still know the history. And we are representing our elders who sent us, were messengers on behalf of the rest of the tribe. And they said to us, all the people living in our land, wherever that land is, you know, somewhere out there, that we were told to take provisions, go towards the Jews, say that we are your servants, and make a covenant. And of course, the idea of covenant basically means once you made the agreement, no going back. And this is one of the big, big questions. The Gemara deals with this question, you'll see in a minute. And they say, and they give more discussion, you know, to plead their case. Zelachmenu, this is our bread, they said. Cham nitztayadnu oto mibatenik. We took it out of our houses, it was still hot. And we went out to go towards you. Look, the bread is dry. And it's even got a bit of mold. In other words, you can see it's old moldy bread. And they show all the exhibits, right? It's like a court case. These are our bottles of wine. Kadashim, they were new. Now they've split because, you know, we've walking such a long time. And look at our clothing, it's tattered and schmatters, and the shoes are falling off our feet. And that's the ploy. Now, the credible thing is, now the people saw, they took the provision, in other words, they checked them out, but they didn't ask God. Now, this is very interesting because the question of asking Hashem is something that we've dealt with in our Tanakh studies really for a number of years. Every so often there is a situation where you ask what is called Urim V'Tumim. You go to the Kohen Gadol, he wears this breastplate, you put in an instant message to God and it lights up. Alright, and that's basically what it is. In this case they didn't ask. Now, again, is this a critique of the people not asking? Is this something that they felt they didn't have to ask? It's a question here, and I don't know.
I don't think your Urim V'Tumim was something you, you know, every 5 minutes you ask the question.
You didn't do it every 5 minutes, exactly.
Not some, I don't think this was something you asked. You know, I say, look at the evidence.
And that was it. Judgment call. And I think you're right. The only thing is that the pasuk seems to suggest this as being a critique. But they should have asked and they didn't ask.
Otherwise
it wouldn't say
that
it.
I understand.
Yeah, yeah. But should they have really gone?
That's why I don't understand why the pasuk is there.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good question. And again, as I said, I don't know. I'm not sure. The suggestion may be because they, you know what, you're accepting converts under these circumstances, that may have been so controversial, we needed to put in a shaila. We needed to send a message, an instant message up to him. And they had a lot of other people as well. You're right. You're right. So it's strange. That part of it is strange. But clearly, that with hindsight, Yeshua is writing this, right, after the event, and he's obviously saying that, you know what, we really should have asked God, but we didn't.
Why didn't Yeshua ask?
Yeah, it's saying the men of Israel, but including Yeshua. In other words, you know, why didn't they suggest that would have been the way to go? It's interesting. This is the pasuk which I'm not clear on as to what it's trying to imply, but my feeling is that it's implying a criticism. But let's go on. Vayasahem Yeshua Shalom. Yeshua took the initiative to make peace. Very interesting. The end of the day, it's the leaders that are going to sort of be looked at to make peace. Vayichrot lehem brit lachayotam, and he made a covenant to keep them alive. Vayishavu lehem nesi'ayda, and the elders made the oath. In other words, it was the decision of Yeshua, and the promise was made by the leaders of the congregation of the Jewish people. Vayihi miktzei shaloshet yomim, and it took another 3 days. Acharei asher katu lehem brit, after they made the covenant, then they found out the whole story. Everybody realized that these people were coming from right down the road, not from another country. And they are living right amongst the nations that they are told that they had to fight and eventually destroy. So the Jews are up in arms. What we can't accept these people. That we everything was under false pretenses. Think about this. Think about Yeshua's position. And as I said, it's the exact same situation again and again and again. It's held against us because we do what I can only describe as the right thing. Yeshua took them at face value. He was being a decent guy. All right, even though they were tricking him, he didn't want to remotely have a sense of tricking them. But listen to this. Because what happened was that the Jews found their cities where they came from. It's Kiryat Yarim, all of those places which are just around, just before Jerusalem. And the Jews accepted the decision not to fight them or to kill them. Because the promise had been made by Hashem Elokei Yisrael, by the God of name of God, the Hashem, the God of Israel. But everybody started complaining. You made a very big mistake. Alright? Now what is so interesting is the status of this Shavua. Is it a valid oath? Because you could really argue that the oath is being made under false pretenses, right? So it's the same story that we have later on with Yiftach. When Yiftach says, whatever comes out of my house will be holy to God, he makes a vow. Who comes out of his house? Remember the story? His daughter, Nebuch. And according to the Ramban, he actually killed her. Because he promised to make a sacrifice, so first thing that comes out of his house. So again, all the rabbis are asking, but isn't the oath made under false pretenses? In this case, it's different to the Yiftach case, which is a more private case in a way. This is a more public case. There's one element here which is kind of glaring. But it's something that we are held to a higher standard. And the word that the Gemara uses, and I can show you this. In fact, what we'll do, we'll just finish the chapter. I'll just show you the Gemara on this, and you'll see whether you're comfortable with it. It's just another few psukim. So listen to this. It says that they made the promise. So now the people said, we can't touch you. You're amongst us, and that's the end of the story. And the Givonim remained amongst the Jewish people for many, many years. The Gemara talks about them later on, and there's a whole discussion about their status. And they're very, very interesting that this was respected. And in fact, much later on in the story of in Shmuel Bet, if you remember, there was a whole story at the end of Shmuel Bet about the Givonim exacting revenge from Shaul. Because Shaul had killed some of them in the story of Nov when he was chasing after David. And at the end of Shmuel Bet, they come back to David and they say, we want to take revenge on Shmuel. And David says, I've got no choice. Because Yeshua, you made a covenant with Yeshua. I've got to respect what you want. Even though I don't want to do it, I can't go back on what we did. The covenant stands. The promise stands. And again, the question is why? It was made under false pretenses. You see what the Gemara says. Gemara's got an answer to this. But hang on one second.
We're talking about the Nesinim all over the place. We're talking about the
Nesinim all the time. They're different because in the Nesinim there's also Geri Arroyos much later on, which we learned about in Sefer Melachim. See, the beauty of learning Yeshua is that once you learn the rest of Tanakh, you can go back and then you can sort of plug in everything that you've learned, you know, subsequently, the later books, and bring it back to Yeshua. That's really one of the great things. If you can remember all that stuff. Yeah. Yeah. But it's a similar sort of thing. But listen to this. Chat. Zod naseh lahem. But this is what we'll do. Vachyeh otam. V'lo yaleinu ketsev. Ala shvua shenishbarnu lahem. But they don't want to have any anger from God for what they promised. So this is the deal. V'yomru aleihem anasim. Yichyu. The princes said. The prince of Israel said they will live. Yuchot ve'eitzim v'shov ve'mayim. And they should be people who schleppers, the water schleppers, and the people who chop the wood, they'll do menial tasks. V'cholo eidak hasher dibru lohem, as the princes had promised. V'yikro lohem Yeshua v'yidaber aleim le'mor. Yeshua called them and said to them, Lama remitem otanu. He complains. Right? You know, in the end of the day, you tricked us. Le'mor, rechokim anachnu mikem ma'od. You said you're coming from far away. V'atem b'kibeni Yoshua. You're dwelling around the corner. So Yeshua is venting here. He's saying you are cursed, right? He's giving them a klala. In other words, that you will never ever stop being what we said that you will be, but you'll never get close to holiness. You'll never draw water for the house of God. Right? You won't come near to the God of Israel, but you'll be doing all of this stuff. As far as they're concerned, they don't care. Vayanuz Yoshua Vayomer, and they said to Yoshua in response, Ki hu God, hu gate hu God lavadecha et asher tziva Hashem lokecha et Moshe. We know what God had commanded Moses, Avdo, his servant, Lotet lechem et kol ha'aretz, to give you the land, Lashmid et kol yishvei aretz mipnechem, and destroy all the people. V'niromo, we were scared, l'nafshoteinu, we were petrified. V'bnechem v'naseh devazeh, that's why we did what we did. And they're honest. At this point, they become honest. V'yata hinenu biyodecha, now we're in your hands. Katov k'yasha b'enecha, lasot lo ruach. Say, do what is good and right in your eyes. And again, this, you hear the echoes. I mean, you know, that as long as we do the right thing, as long as Am Yisrael does the right thing, you can trick us, you can promise, you can make Madrid agreements, Oslo agreements, you know, you name it, where the number of pieces of paper have been flying around in the last 30 years. And we give everything. We gave back Gush Katif. What a tragedy. What an unbelievable mistake. And it's echoes of history. It's the same story. As long as we do the right thing, they can trick us and play the game over and over and over again. And what did Yeshua do? Vayas them Cain, and he did exactly what they said. Vayatzel otam miyad b'nei Yisrael v'la'agum, and he made sure that they weren't killed. Vayid name Yeshua b'yamahu chatvei tzim v'shov imayim, he made sure they were in those particular professions that they were doing, schlepping water, etc. La'edo l'mizbeach Hashem adayom hazeh, ela makom asher yivcha. In other words, he allowed them to sort of become even a bit closer for the mizbeach Hashem. All right, which they said originally in his anger, he said, you won't even come to that. I suppose once they owned up, he felt maybe a bit of conscience or whatever, and he was bringing them a bit closer to God. I think the problem is, and this is always the big problem, is the effect of having these types of influences amongst the Jewish people. You already get to the beginning of Book of Shoftim, and we spoke about this many, many years ago already, the whole problem of the intermarriage that took place, because intermarriage between the children, even if the non-Jewish partner converted, the parents did not convert. So what you had is interaction between the Jews and the idolaters, the pagans, and eventually the whole situation in Sefer Shoftim goes completely out of hand. It goes bad, from bad to worse, except when the Shofet comes along and tries to bring the situation back again. I just want to show you very, very briefly what the Gemara does with Yoshua's oath, because it's very, very interesting. There's just a page I want to give out. If you just sort of pass those sort of behind you. Just have a look at this. This is taken from the Gemara in Gittin, page 46. Gemara, page 46 in Gittin. And I'll just show you, we'll just read from the section B. The Art Scroll Gemara. And it gives you the context of what this is about. It's a machloket in the Mishnah about a vow which can be rescinded or cannot be rescinded. Obviously, this is going to be the discussion with Yoshua. So listen to this. There's the Gemara's section B. Kol neida sheyedibu rabim. Oh, sorry, Rabbi Yehuda Omer. Rabbi Yehuda says, Kol neida sheyedibu rabim lo yachzir. Right? If, for instance, talking about a case of divorce, let's get it. So he says, if a person divorced because of any vow that was known to the public, you may not take her back. In other words, that vow is known to the public, and you divorced her because of it. Once you've made the divorce, that's it, it's final. For shalom yodibar rabim, but if the community, the public doesn't know about it, yachzid, then you can take her back. It was made in private, and the vow can be annulled. And that's the Mishnah, but I don't want to go into that discussion, but look at the Gemara here. My ta'ama, I'm Rabbi Yehuda ben Levi, my ta'ama de Rabbi Yehuda. There's an opinion in the Mishnah of Rabbi Yehuda, and what we read at the beginning, and the Rabbi Yehuda ben Levi wants to know what is the reason for Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. Why does he hold that if a vow is known to the public, it's fixed, it's firm, it can never be rescinded? So he says, I'll tell you why, because of the story of Yoshua that we just read. Dichtiv, because it says, V'lo hikum b'nei Yisrael. They weren't slain by the Jews. The Givonim were protected. V'chi nishbu lahem nisiei adar. It says because the elders of the community made a promise. They made a vow. And that vow was honored. So because the vow was honored, even though it was made, and it wasn't made with a correctness because of the fact that it was all done by ruse or whatever, nevertheless, once it became known that the vow was made, it stands. And that's the story of the Givonim, according to Rabbi Yehuda. In the Mishnah, there is a disagreement. And the Rabbanan, the other side of the argument, disagree with Rabbi Yehuda. And they say that in fact this vow can be rescinded. If the vow can be rescinded, then what's going on with Yeshua? Why didn't they rescind the promise which was made under false pretenses? So the Gemara says, Rabbanan, the rabbis, what do they do with the story of Yeshua? Hatam, they say over there in the case of Yeshua, Mi chalashvua ilavayu kla. In other words, that's the question. Did the vow take place at all? According to the Rabbanan, these vows can be retracted. They can go back on them. In which case, if it's made wrongly, maybe the vow should be rescinded. Maybe the givonim should be punished for what they did. So the question is, why not? So the answer is like this. Kivan d'amru lehu. Since the Gibeonites said, Me eretz rechoka banu. They came from a faraway place, Velobo, and they had not come from such a place, right? Lo chayla shvuai alayu klal. The vow should not have taken place at all. And the last three lines, v'hai delo katlinu. So why then did the Jews not kill them if they are made a vow which was in error? The answer is mibnei kedushat Hashem. Now nowadays we put it in the negative form because of chilul Hashem. If Yeshua would have gone back on this, then even though he might have had the legal reason for doing so, what we would call the halachic reason for doing so, he would have made a chilul Hashem. Now that blows the mind, because that's what it's all about. The bottom line is that the expectation for what we do in today's world, and this is going right back into the ancient world, is because if we don't do the right thing, then we are profaning the name of God. That is the bottom line. That's the expectation. I don't think the non-Jewish world can verbalize it in such a way, but that's the way we verbalize it. That we are expected to make a Kiddush Hashem at any possible time. It's unbelievable. And this is something that we've lived with for the last 3,000 years. And today we're living with it, really living with it. Right? The expectation that we will give, we're always going to be doing the right thing, even if they play us, even if they make promises which they won't keep. And this is an unbelievable thing. There's a long Tosfos which I'm not going to go through. Which, you know, if you want to look at it, it's very very interesting Tosfos, because he says that this vow should not have been kept anyway because it's cancelling a mitzvah. The mitzvah was to destroy these enemies, and therefore how can you even make a vow against the mitzvah? And he goes into that whole halachic debate. But the bottom line of what we're saying here is very very fascinating. That either you say that the vow had a validity according to Rabbi Yehuda, or you say no, it had no validity, but Yeshua could not do anything because of Chilul Hashem, what the Gemara calls Kedushat Hashem. I like the fact the Gemara puts it in the positive. At least it makes it more, sort of comforts us a bit more, that we have to make a Kiddush Hashem. I just want to add one thing, because we're coming to the end of the Shir. I just want to say what Rav Mali says, because I think it's very interesting. His suggestion is that Yeshua was not so naive. You know, when you finish the chapter, you ask yourself, was Yeshua duped? Was he tricked? And the initial reaction, I suppose, is to say, yeah, it looks as if they really put a number on him. But Ramali says something very interesting. He says that if you think about it, north of Jerusalem is like a dividing part of the country between north and south. That whole area of Givon, if you go from Yerushalayim north, that whole area right across the country is a kind of dividing line between the north of the country and the south of the country. And what his suggestion is that Yeshua, in fact, allowed this to take place because what he wanted to do was to divide up the enemy between the north and the south. Some of the tribes were living in the north, some of the enemy tribes were living in the south, and you had this band right across the country of a friendly area, a sort of, you know, a zone, which would be, at peace with the Jewish people. And it became like a break between the north and the south. And it's fascinating because he says, if you look at chapter 10, you'll see there's a new covenant made with a certain number of those tribes against the Jews. And then you look at chapter 11, there's another covenant. And he says the difference between chapter 10 and chapter 11 is chapter 10 is the tribes of the north above the Gibeonites, and chapter 11 is the tribes of the south below the Gibeonites, that they had to make new covenants because the band of land that was now friendly to Am Yisrael, belonging to the tribes of Givon, split the country into two parts. And this maybe was Yeshua's reason for accepting them, even though, according to, I suppose, strict letter of the law, he should have thrown them out of court. And it's fascinating. And the suggestion is that, therefore, strategically, Strategically, there was a reason for, I hope that makes sense. Strategically, there was a reason for Yeshua to accept them, even though the story looks so negative and the Gemara's got this whole discussion about the promises that were made under false pretenses. The bottom line is that Yeshua really did have, possibly had, a method to this particular circumstance. And I find that very interesting. I find that when you learn Tanakh from Rabbonim who live in Eretz Yisrael, who live Eretz Yisrael, then, you know, sometimes they come up with a chiddush like that because they just know the geography. You know, we can talk about the geography of the country we're in, but the geography of Israel, which is such a small country, but unless you're really there, very hard to put that into practice. But Rav Mali here, one of the svarim that I've been referring to, he does that, and I think it makes a lot of sense to me, that this break between the north and the south is what Yeshua was trying to achieve. Yechol Yot, it's a suggestion. I'm not sure if it's 100%, but it certainly makes it makes for good reading. Let's put it that way. Mitzvah Shem, chapter 10. You're getting to the climax here. Chapter 10, chapter 11, the sun standing still. Shemesh Begivon Dom. One of the most famous stories in the whole of the Bible and the whole of history. Okay, I'm not going to go through the scientific. You want to do something interesting, Google. There's an article that was written not so long ago about the whole issue of time. If the world stood still and time sort of stopped for a certain period of time, is what we're claiming, then, you know, the whole question scientifically of the axis and the revolutions of the Earth, etc. There's a lot of discussion about that. I think there was a National Geographic article about it not so long ago. So you can Google that if you try and find it. If you find it, please try and make a copy, because I know it's been written about quite recently. To be continued. We're coming to the really good bits. Really good bits. And to be continued. It's a shame next week. Thank you, everybody.